Welcome, everyone, to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In our podcast, we showcase stories from the magazine so you can get a sense of what we're about. For this episode, we bring you The Green Man by James Tipton from our September-October 2022 issue. It's another story featuring Sherlock Holmes' friend and chronicler, Dr. James H. Watson. As depicted here, Watson is himself a formidable sleuth, and when Holmes is not available, Watson travels to North Wales to take on a case involving ancient myth and the construction of a new railway tunnel. Novelist and poet and student of the author Conan Doyle stories, James Tipton teaches English and creative writing at the College of Marin in California. Here he is reading his story, The Green Man.
It was a gloomy evening on the winter solstice of 97. The sky hung dirty white and low over the bare trees in Regent's Park, where I took my stroll after my lunch at the corner pub. It was a bit of a heavy meal, mutton pie, a generous amount of mushy green ginger peas, and a pint of McEwen's ale. And it was invigorating to walk it off by the pond while thinking of nothing in particular. I reflected how both Holmes and I liked our own company, and perhaps that is one of the reasons we got along so easily. We would sit in our respective armchairs by the fire for hours in the evening, or take long walks in the park, and hardly say a word the whole time but be contented and comfortable. Now, as I noticed a pair of rooks descend to a leafless branch, I left the park, crossed Baker Street, and observed that in the short time I had been gone, dark had descended as well as the rooks, and the gas lamps lit, the sunset on the shortest day of the year well hidden behind the London murk. As I approached 221B, I also thought, though, of how much I like the bare boughs, the cold, bracing air, for they indicate a time of rest for all, for nature and for man. Sherlock Holmes had few callers at Christmas, and my patient seemed to wait until after Yuletide to become ill, so it was with some curiosity that I observed a small man, wrapped up in muffler and heavy coat, standing by our door and lifting the knocker to no avail. Mrs. Hudson was having her rest, too, visiting her sister, and Holmes, bored with the inaction, had repaired to Norway, he said, to hike the fjords to keep in shape. I doubted that was the real cause, or even the real location of his sojourn, for when he was dangerously inactive, his brother often supplied him with some secret high-stakes international game of which I had no part. I was just happy my friend was craving work, and not an artificial stimulus for his abnormally active brain. But there was this little man, who also perhaps could have cured the brooding calm in Holmes's life. "Whom do you seek, sir?" I asked the man, who, in the light of the lamp by the pub, had small, pinched eyes behind thick spectacles. "Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I've been to Scotland Yard. I saw Inspector Stanley Hopkins, who appears to know you, and said my case was more in your line." Holmes admired the young inspector and always found rewarding the cases he sent our way. "I'm afraid, sir, you are mistaken. I am Dr. Watson. The detective is out of the country for the Christmas season." The man looked remarkably downcast. "I've come a long way, from North Wales. My letter went unanswered, so my employer said I should come in person." I paused a moment. I cherished my solitary evenings. Tonight I would read a new account on the second Afghan campaign and reasons behind the disastrous Battle of Maiwand in which I had played a small part. The man glanced down the street as if looking for a cab. "Come in and tell me what your problem is," I said, "and I will see if I, as Sherlock Holmes's associate, can give you any small suggestion. I guarantee nothing, though. An associate is not the same as the man himself." As I put the key in the lock, the little man said, "I would be ever so grateful for any insight you could provide." His name was Percival Pritchard, and when I had added some coals to the ones that were smoldering, and given the man a snifter of brandy for the cold, he started in. "You see, there is this green man," he said. "Pardon?" "You know, the green man. Surely the character of country legends and festivals." "I've heard of him, but he is a giant. Surely you know that. At springtime revels, a tall fellow from the village plays his part on stilts, all dressed up like the green man of legend." I was longing now for my tea and the account of my wand. "Perhaps, Mr. Pritchard, I am not the best one to ask after all. Perhaps a professor at the University of London or of Wales would be more informed on the subject." "There's nothing to be informed about. He has appeared, or his likeness has, and is frightening the workers in the railway tunnel that the company I represent is building. There are those in the village who say, that's where the traditional green man hails from. His green chapel, they say, there, under the mountain. It sounds like a load of rubbish, but there's those that believe it. And this creature is no phantom. He's actually done bodily harm to two foremen and three railway workers who opposed him. Broke one man's arm, another one's jaw. The miners we hired from the adjacent valley won't help any more. And our own men are better at laying track than at tunneling through mountains. We won't meet the deadline for the connection to Holyhead. The miners have actually gone on strike against us. It's been going on for a fortnight. My employer, the head of North Wales Railway, sent me to London to seek help. He says we'll lose a fortune if we don't connect with the Holyhead line in time. What about the local constabulary, Larry, I said. Can't they stand guard against this giant and put the workers at their ease? They say it's not their province. It's just superstitious villagers who have found an excuse not to go to work at Christmas time. Is there any truth in that? Some of the miners, I understand, believe that there is a possibility of truth in old stories. But their mining wages won't cover a good Christmas goose. They need the extra work. They are genuinely frightened. I can see why Scotland Yard didn't think this was in their line, I said. It sounds like a local bizarre affair. It's a railway affair, and railroads, Dr. Watson, are the life veins of this nation. Railroads are what make Great Britain great. A threat to the railway anywhere is a threat to Britain everywhere. You should run for office, Mr. Pritchard. I'm not only the close associate, but the local representative of my employer, and as such am often his public voice. And I know he would pay with an open hand for a visit from an associate of Sherlock Holmes, said Pritchard. You can just do some investigations, write a respected outsider's report, and be home for Christmas. Christmas is 4 days away, I said. But in truth, I was going to dine at my club and walk and read on Christmas Day. You could see for yourself if it's superstitious nonsense or not. Could be a Christmas pantomime, I said. Not if you get your arm broke, it's not. An ancient myth come to life, Dr. Watson. It's worth a look, eh? There's a train, 6:15. You can hole up at the village pub. Good pies and Welsh ale there. I could always read on the train. I reflected that about a year and a half ago I had departed from Paddington in a similar direction for a holiday and ended up embroiled in the tragedy on the slopes of Mount Snowdon. When he wasn't expounding on railroads as the backbone of the nation's progress, Mr. Pritchard proved a dull companion. I was able to read the account on the Afghan campaign after all and heard a different point of view on what made Great Britain great, the expansion of its empire. That, even if that was a failed attempt, it was a noble enterprise. I still had a piece of shrapnel in my leg to prove it. I arrived in time for some leek soup and brown bread at the pub, and the landlady, a matronly Mrs. Davies, showed me my room. She had already heard why I was here. "I haven't read any of your stories, Dr. Watson, but I have heard of that detective. If you're working for him, it would be wise for you to start with the girl who works at the bar. She's just about to leave now, and she won't come back till noon, so you might be wanting to talk with her right away. She played the role of the Green Man in the Christmas pantomime last week, about the time these mysterious appearances of the Green Man began. She's a big girl and could hold her own against any railway man or miner. That's one reason I hired her. But she'll close early if that man of hers comes in, and that doesn't sit well with me. You go down right now after you've put your portmanteau on that dresser there. She'll be walking out with Owen Owens if you tarry. I thanked the landlady and was soon at the bar ordering a Welsh ale. Dr. Watson, she said as she brought me the glass, your legend precedes you. I'm afraid it's the legend of my friend Sherlock Holmes, but it's fact, not legend. Like the fact of the legendary Green Man, known since pagan times from Somerset to Scotland, appearing in a tunnel in North Wales. Something like that. And you are? Lucy Daniels. I suppose you already heard I'm a prime suspect because I got up on stilts at the Christmas Panto and last May Day and performed the role of the Green Man with great relish. She was taller than I, well-built, and with big bones. Her dark eyes flashed, and I thought she could probably throw me across the room. I roared and raged above the crowd, Dr. Watson. I held my goblet high. I was Dickens's ghost of Christmas present incarnate, hale and hearty above the humble crowd at my feet. I thought, it's true. These Welsh have a natural strain of music in their speech. I said nothing. How could I, in response to her eloquence, and sipped my rich ale. Nevertheless, Miss Daniels continued, I do not make appearances outside of regularly scheduled performances. That is, I do not appear in tunnels for gratis and frighten poor workers who should be minding their own minds and not tunneling for an English lord of the manor, such as the Fat Man. So you see, I'm all on the side of the Green Man. The only thing is, my stilts are missing. Stolen? Who can say? After the panto, I went backstage to take them up to the attic above the pub, where we keep them, and they weren't there. Some boys playing a prank, I thought. Then, these mysterious appearances started. Even I couldn't play a good Green Man without those stilts. Ah, there's my man. Into the pub walked a broad-shouldered man with an equally broad smile. Miss Daniels quickly went from behind the bar to in front of it. Closing time! She announced to two men playing cards in the corner and to me. Leave your glasses on the bar, please. She took a heavy coat and a muffler from the rack by the door, put her arm through that of her big friend, and over her shoulder said to me, See that Jenny Jones, the perfect school teacher. She'll tell you all you need to know and more about the Green Man. And she tossed her black, shining hair and gazed with expectant happiness into the face of Owen Owens, who hadn't even glanced at me. The next morning, after I had tucked into my late tidy breakfast of rashers and eggs and strong tea, I inquired the way to the school and walked along the ice-slick street by the baker, the butcher, the greengrocer, the poulterer, and the blacksmith, and received inquiring looks from any and all villagers. Across from the white wooden chapel, beneath the hill upon which sat the grey stone church, was the school with its bell and the bairns, lucky for me, squealing and scurrying on the snow-patched grass in their first recess of the day. I realize, in this account, that I'm writing in my room at the pub. I am partaking in the penchant for alliteration that seems to be the natural mode of expression in this village. And there, by the open door of the schoolroom, her arms crossed and her eyes taking in any possible recalcitrance of her charges, her chestnut hair done neatly up in a bun and her eyeglasses and a watch on tube ribbons around her neck, stood the attractive Jenny Jones. I wondered how long the recess was. Miss Jones, I said and shook her hand. I know who you are. I'm honored, she said, to speak with such a famous author. It is the exploits of my friend that create their own fame, I said. Nevertheless, I teach reading and writing. Who does not read and like the writing of Dr. Watson? I'm flattered, I said. I was told you're the local expert on the Green Man. Ah, that would take some time to explain properly. I can loan you some books from the library, but suffice it to say, before recess is over, that the Green Man is a force of nature. the representative of its irrepressible power and energy and rejuvenation. You know those lines by Hopkins? And for all this, he's referring to the pillaging and plundering of our land by factories and the fat men who run them. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. That inexhaustible freshness is the Green Man. That's why he has been part of the May Day celebrations for a millennium. The spirit of nature can't be killed. If you cut off his head, as Sir Gawain did in the poem, he'd just lumber around, pick it up, pop it back on his neck, bleeding into his green tunic, and ride off on his green horse. But not before the head, held by its green hair by a green hand, opens its eyes and delivers to Gawain a stern message to meet him at the Green Chapel. You see, the Green Knight is more powerful than any of the great knights at Arthur's court, more powerful than us, and we tinker with him at our peril, hence the problem with the tunnel. That's his domain, you know. She lifted one of the ribbons and looked at her watch. Time's up, she said, and pulled the rope on the bell. The children came running up and formed an instant line. She raised her hand, and they silenced. Even the pushing between two boys stopped. I admired her power. This, she said, gesturing to me, is the famous writer of the Sherlock Holmes stories. They looked at me as if I had the inside knowledge of where Father Christmas spent his holidays. Have you seen dead bodies? Asked one of the boys. Dr. Watson has served in the Queen's Army in Afghanistan, Billy. Like hundreds of thousands of soldiers, he has probably had the misfortune of seeing dead bodies. As a doctor, he has also had the responsibility of caring for wounded ones, said Miss Jones. Now, no more talking. File back in and take your places at your desks. Some of the children looked up at me curiously as they passed. See Billy Williams, she said to me as she herself filed back in the schoolhouse, the blacksmith. He knows more about your Green Man and why he's appearing at this time. I tipped my hat. The second formal woman I've met in this town, I thought. I heard the clank-clank of hammer on anvil before I saw the fellow, in his black leather apron and stained white shirt rolled up to the elbows and revealing powerful forearms. This man could have broken a man's jaw, I thought. He had a bushy black beard and blue eyes that beamed out at me and took in my city clothes and hat and surmised my identity and purpose. It was a small village. He put down his hammer and tongs and extended a hearty hand. Dr. Watson, I presume. Billy Wally Williams. Have a seat. There was a rough bench behind the forge, and Mr. Williams lifted a large clay flask of water from the bench so I could sit down, and himself took a long drop. He passed the flask to me, and I shook my head. Fat railway men, he said, starting right in. I remarked to myself that Miss Jones had used a similar phrase, which I had thought unladylike coming from her. It seemed natural coming from the blacksmith's mouth. We're a mining town, he went on, and proud to be one. But those poor souls work in the bowels of the earth most of their lives, only see the sunlight at dawn or twilight, and now at the solstice not at all. I'm a lucky sod working in the open air. But when the English railway men come and say, we are digging a tunnel through your mountain and demand our workers to do it, it happens to be in the sacred valley of the Green Man. Someone is likely to put up a fuss. That's the mystery. And the only real question is to why one of those fat men hasn't been killed, not just a couple of his workers knocked around. Sounds like a threat, I said. The blacksmith took another swig of water and wiped his mouth with his arm. They're threatening us, he said. Be part of Great Britain with its great railways, or be damned as Welshmen living in the past. Why is it a sacred valley? Hasn't someone told you? Have you talked to the pretty school teacher? She knows. For one thing, it's the Valley of the Green Chapel from the ancient poem about Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Haven't you read it? I confess it wasn't part of my curriculum at university. It's only in manuscript form. It's so old no one knows who wrote it. But we in North Wales know the story. You see, Camelot was down there in West Somerset near Glastonbury, When the Green Knight goes to challenge the knights and Sir Gawain lops off his head, which the knight tidily puts back on. "I've heard that part," I said. "Good man. You're not so ignorant, then. You know, Gawain gave his word to meet the Green Knight in a year and a day at the Green Chapel. After searching all the way from Glastonbury, Gawain finally meets him in the valley just up the way, at the place the fat man is building his tunnel. It was a sacred place before that, but that's another story. The railway men care nothing about the land itself and its ancient stories. They lay their rails on God's green earth and belch their smoke into blue skies and pour their waste into pure streams. It's been passed down to us by our ancestors who have lived in this valley for centuries that this is the place, the Green Chapel itself. Listen, there are high ridges with pinnacles like sharp teeth, standing out like sentinels on both sides of the valley, just as the text says, and that's a rare enough feature. And there's the odd-shaped mound by a brook, and this hill has a hole in it, an old cave, exactly how the text describes the Green Chapel. And the fat man sees that cave and thinks a perfect place to start my tunnel. They told him it was an old, revered site, and of course that meant nothing. Now they're reaping the consequences. Broken arms, our miners not working for them, and there's one other thing, Dr. Watson. The man lifted the flask and took a final long swallow. I know you've heard of the Holy Grail. Of course. Who found it? After a long search, only Sir Galahad, I believe. Sir Bors and Sir Percival as well, but that's no matter. I marveled that a blacksmith could be so well-read, but I was in Wales, the land of ancient stories and the original Britons. The point is, it's also believed that the Green Knight was guarding the Grail, brought by Joseph of Arimathea to Britain, and hidden in this obscure place for safekeeping. Whether you believe in the legends or not, Doctor, you see this is controversial ground upon which to cut into the earth and lay your steel rails. So you think someone is righteously trying to protect this ancient site from exploitation? Exactly. I don't know who, but I'll applaud the man or woman who has the courage and gumption to stand up to the fat man. Go see the English head of the North Wales Railway. He lives in his plush train car up the valley, just waiting and wishing for the chance to sit in his velvet-lined chair and watch the dark walls go darting by when the tunnel's finished. But it will never be finished. Mark my words. If it's not some righteous soul, as you said, fighting for the right of our land, it's the spirit of the green man himself, taking form as the frightened eyes of those under the earth would see him, a massive shape, capable of mangling an arm or pinioning a leg under a rock for eternity. All I know is it's not a happy spirit, not anymore. Well, a horseshoe here and a cartwheel there, Dr. Watson, that's what I'm back to in our simple village. Go visit the fat man, name of Coldstead. Adam Coldstead. He's probably heard of me and of my thoughts. Probably thinks I'm out to destroy Britain rather than maintain my corner of Wales. Good day, Doctor. I lunched at the pub. Trout and chips and strong tea. And hired the one-horse cab in the village to take me up the valley to the train car of Adam Coldstead and asked the cabbie to wait. I put it on Coldstead's bill. I heard an angry voice as I mounted the steps and held my hand up, about to knock. The only word I discerned was, fanatics. The door was opened by little Pritchard himself. He looked glad to see me and introduced me to his employer, who, not rising from his vermilion velvet-lined chair behind a broad mahogany desk, stuck out a meaty hand. He was indeed a corpulent soul, with mutton chops running down to his chin, a bank full of chins, and a red velvet smoking jacket over a white silk waistcoat and cravat. His only hair was grain bushes that protruded from either side of his head and descended to join his mutton chops. "Come to find out who's holding the game up, are you? Pritchard here said he found you, although your master is out. All you need to do is to verify that there are villains behind this scheme, Welsh radicals, socialists, and unionists. And the sooner we can get some troops in here to secure progress, the better. You've gained enough evidence to pass on, then, to your superiors? I found out. Talked with the radical leader, the blacksmith. They make up a charade from an old myth instead of saying what it is. Downright defiance of the law. I know these people, fought them all my life, these men who call themselves the mouthpieces of the people, and are really out to bring down our country. How did you arrive here in Wales, Doctor? By what means did you travel?
By train.
Precisely. And those criss-crossing rails are the arteries of our nation and of its future. We've even built them in India. India, sir, a country sweltering in the heat of age-old ignorance. Or Africa, barely out of the trees, and they can see the jungle go by from a train window. And these socialists want to keep this progress from North Wales. Give me a little evidence, and I will have this man and his band at the dock.
You said he's a leader?
You don't know. What sort of detective are you? Write down your report and return to London. I'll doctor it up for you, Doctor.
And the man chuckled at his witticism.
Pritchard chuckled, too, and poured some port into a crystal tumbler on his master's desk. He didn't offer me any. This blacksmith has, by night, a different trade. He's the leader of a band who call themselves the Keepers of the Green Chapel. Sworn to protect by any means the plain knoll into which I need to bore my tunnel. Nature has provided a cavity, a perfect entrance, and saved me some money and time. These fanatics were out to destroy a simple railway that will convenience the lives and travel of their fellow man. But do they care? Here's what I'll do. You deliver a report on your findings to Pritchard here, to give us some objective evidence in procuring official force, as it seems necessary, with all the miners striking and the tunnel at a standstill, and not wanting to wait for all the red tape, I will go myself to the tunnel tonight, with my pistol, mind you, to see if this mysterious green man appears, and if he approaches me, I can fire in self-defense and watch his costume gain a red color and a supernatural status crumble at my feet. Sound like a plan?
Not to me, I said. I need to talk to more people, get more insights.
No more talk, said Adam Colstead. The time for talk is over. Go see the mine director, though, that Tommy Thomas. I'm sure he is, if not actively involved, in full support of the miners' strike and the absurd green man's antics. This magic man did bodily harm to two of my foremen. That's a criminal offense, is it not? See what Tommy Thomas has to say and include it in a report that condemn him and his partners in crime. The man had the temerity to come into my car and threaten me this morning. We, Pritchard, threw him out, holding on to his belt and heaving. I believe he landed on some stiff rails. Good day, Doctor. Repair to London by tonight's train. My payment for your services will cease at midnight. That should give you enough time. Pritchard saw me out, and as we stepped down from the train car, a section of rail clattered off a passing, heavily loaded car and fell at our feet. Pritchard bent down and pushed it off our path. These miniature lines are always loaded, sometimes carelessly, he said, but they're for our own quick transportation of supplies, always ready and always full. We're a busy business, Doctor. Even with the work stalled, we're piling it all at the tunnel's mouth for when we resume. I'm sure Mr. Colstead has given you ample food for thought, and I look forward to reading your report. Whether it will be entirely to your approval or not, so remains to be seen. But, as Colstead said, he can doctor it up, I said. I would take Colstead's advice and have one more interview now before I'd write that report. I told the cabbie to take me to the office of Thomas Thomas. He knew where it was. Up the next snowy valley, beside the slushy entrance to the mine, at a long, low wooden building upon which the title Thomas Mining Company was written in big block letters, Tommy Thomas met me at the door as soon as I knocked.
"Working for the enemy, eh, Doctor?" he said in his Welsh lilt. "I wondered when you'd arrive. Sit down, brandy? He had short coal-black hair, black bright eyes, and a sturdy, medium build. No, thank you. He sat back in his wooden swivel chair, gave it a jaunty spin, and said, "You want to hear how I'm sending the country to the devil by impeding progress?" Something like that. "Do you know what is the lifeblood of Great Britain?" "Not railways, Doctor, but Welsh coal." "How do you survive the winter in your rooms in London? Am I right? How did you come here? By one of Coalstead's railway lines?" "No, by the power of steam and coal." "Were their trains budge an inch without my coal?" "The man's a dunce, a dullard, a dimwit, buffoon in his upholstered train car. He's a caricature of himself, a bully. He comes in here and press gangs my miners into service, has some supposed writ from the Ministry of Transport he waved in front of my face. They're a rough team. He, his foreman, and his little minion. Now his foreman, armed with clubs, stand outside my mine and say, 'If the miners won't work for Coalstead until the tunnel's done, they won't work anywhere.' The men need to eat. Christmas is a few days away. No goodwill towards men here. Coalstead has his gang, but we have the woodwows." "Excuse me? You've talked to Billy, and he didn't tell you?" "We've called ourselves the woodwows since we were boys, the wild men of the woods, a term used in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, when Gawain's on his way to find the Green Chapel. We Welsh wild men will stick together and won't let English interlopers have their way any more." "That sounds like a threat, like something Billy Williams said." "Billy and I think alike. If the woodwows and the keepers of the Grail meet up with railway men, there will be a battle. Mark my words." "Mr. Williams also used that phrase. Your woodwows could elicit the help of the Green Man." "He is definitely on our side." I took the cab back to the pub, wrote up my report for my interviews. I'm afraid that Mr. Thomas, as likable a chap as I found him, was also the most likely candidate for the one behind the attacks. After dinner of call stew, bacon, lamb, cabbage and leeks with crusty bread, Caerphilly cheese and Welsh ale, I was ready to take the last train from here to Cardiff and thence to London and peacefully nap on the way. I had had it with woodwows and greedy cutthroat businessmen and grails and green chapels and, above all, green men. I sent my report, such as it was, off with the messenger boy to Pritchard. I had no desire to see him again, either. My bag was packed when I heard a knock on the door. It was the boy I had sent with the message. "You better come with me, sir," the boy said. "Something awful has happened. I'm to take you to the station." I followed the boy, with eyes peering out of lit windows, along the one narrow street, the early dark having already fallen. At the station, I met Lloyd Lloyd, the chief inspector. I almost laughed at the unoriginality of the Welsh Christian names. Parents didn't have to take much time in deciding on names, but the occasion didn't call for it, I knew. Lloyd informed me that Adam Coalstead was found by one of his foremen and by his assistant Percival Pritchard, who had gone looking for their employer inside the tunnel tonight. Coalstead had a skull bashed in by a heavy rock. Lloyd had my report in his hand. "You verify that this is your report, Doctor, of your interviews and your assessment of the situation up to 5 o'clock this afternoon?" "I do." "Is it true you are an associate of the private detective Sherlock Holmes and have had ample opportunity to observe and reflect on his methods that have become to be relied upon in certain cases by Scotland Yard?" "That is true as well." "Thank you, Doctor. You may go." Just then, two officers came through the door, one on each side of a handcuffed Tommy Thomas. He glanced at me, and I could not quite ascertain the meaning of the look. I thought a comment on woodwows would be out of order. "Thank you for your services, Dr. Watson. Your report here gave us the objective evidence we needed, bolstered by the statements of Percival Pritchard and the foreman, Luke Tumberwell, that Thomas threatened Mr. Coalstead in their presence and has a history of repeated insults and even injuries to representatives of the railways. Apparently, he is in some sort of quasi-religious and political club called the keepers of the Green Chapel. The blacksmith is also involved in this cult, but he has an alibi. He was having dinner with the school teacher. Thomas was seen by more than one witness near the mouth of the tunnel tonight. We are charging him with murder. We appreciate your assistance in this matter, Doctor. Good night. As I walked back to my room at the pub, the jolly holiday feeling of leaving this village had all left me. I felt responsible for the arrest of Thomas, even though others had corroborated my opinions. Thomas probably was guilty, but I liked him. There you have it. And I didn't like Kolstad. I liked Billy Williams and Jenny Jones. I liked the tavern girl, Miss Daniels. None of them liked Kolstad or what he stood for. They all had motivation and means, if not opportunity. Even Jenny, if she worked with Williams, was his Lady Macbeth motivator, so to speak. They could be each other's alibis. I didn't like Pritchard and found him weaseling. It was too cut and dry to arrest Thomas so quickly and say the game was up. As I entered the pub, Williams and Jenny Jones were at a back table. His hand reached across the table and took hers. It looked as though they were plotting together. I had 2 hours before the late train. I'd take a cab up to Kolstad's train car, see if Pritchard was there, and if I could get any first-hand information on the finding of the body. Who were the witnesses who had seen Thomas? I told the cabbie to wait again. He was getting some business out of me. The light was on in the train car, and I went up the steps and knocked on the door. Pritchard himself answered. He looked haggard and worn, as if he had aged years in a single evening. He had no master to serve now. "Come in," he said. "I was just tidying some papers." I know he wasn't a pleasant man, nor an easy man to work for, but he did his job. He laid the rails. I don't know where we'll go now. He was looking down at a stack of papers, as if not seeing them, and running his hand through his thin hair. Perhaps this isn't the time, but I'm returning to London tonight, and I wondered if you could shed any light on the circumstances in which Mr. Kolstad was found. Sit down, Doctor. I'm sorry, I have nothing to offer you. Luke, Mr. Tumberwell, and I took the miniature train to the tunnel, for Mr. Kolstad had been gone longer than we expected at his silly and brash plan to confront the Green Man. We entered the tunnel, shone our lantern around, called his name, and there he was, the big rock still partially on his head. It was awful. I don't know what we're going to do now. He was the life of this company. Did you see anyone near the tunnel? Inspector Lloyd said there were witnesses. We saw no one. There were villagers who saw Thomas approach the tunnel. He had not been long, though. Mr. Kolstad's wrist was still warm when I took the pulse. At this, Pritchard looked down at his papers and shuffled them again. I don't know what we'll do, he repeated. Thank you, I'll see myself out, I said. I'd recommend not doing any more tonight, Mr. Pritchard. Take some rest. Thank you, Doctor. I left him staring at the desk. I went down the steps and couldn't see the cab. Then I saw him on the other side of the train car. He had turned around. Just outside the back of the car, beneath the window, there was a pile of refuse. Lumber, twisted rails, and sticking out of it, I saw what looked like a pair of stilts. I went closer to see if I was correct. I picked one up. It was definitely a stilt. Here was the foothold. As I stood there with it in my hand, a realization dawned. I looked up, and there was the face of Pritchard, wide-eyed, staring at me. We both didn't waste any time. I ran to my cab. As we left, I saw Pritchard get into the miniature train and set off. I heard there were often horses tethered near the tunnel. He could reach one of those, be off over the hills and into any number of directions. In my analysis of motives, I had overlooked one of the most common, avarice. Now Pritchard would be the head of North Wales Railway. I thought the police, however, might be too slow, ask too many questions. They had their man. At the pub, Billy Williams and Jenny Jones were still at their table.
They were deep in talk. I told them what I had found.
Right, was all Williams said. And he and Jenny went out the door.
Jenny looked back first. We'll raise a few keepers, she said, a few wodwos. Wait here, doctor.
I've had many long vigils waiting for or with Sherlock Holmes, but none equal that night of waiting for the return of Williams and Jones. I reproached myself for not realizing the guilt of Pritchard earlier. I should have known when he easily pushed the steel rail out of the way that he had uncommon strength in his small, but I could see now, wiry body. If he lifted that rail, how easily he could have twisted a man's arm until it broke and given a lightning blow to break a jaw. The stilts and costume would just have added to his intimidation. Holmes would have seen this so much earlier. Who was I to think I could put a case together? I bungled everything, and now it was all up to the local ad hoc wodwos, with a schoolteacher nonetheless. A rather formal one, though, I added to myself. I drank my fourth cup of tea. I was too nervous even to light my pipe. Miss Daniels came in on the arm of Big Owen Owens, said she had heard the keepers were on the trail, and soon the pub was filled with people who were anxious to hear the news. Lucy Daniels and Mrs. Davies did a big business that night. Finally, Lloyd arrived and his assistant and said, "What was this club doing, taking the law into their own hands?" Lucy announced that she would now retrieve her stilts and resume her duties as Green Man come the spring. "No," she said, "she'd do it for Twelfth Night." They all cheered. Lloyd looked abashed. Then Ginny, Billy, and one of the other fellows burst in. They looked triumphant, though Billy had a black eye and his friend a split lip. "He's all locked up, Inspector Lloyd," Billy announced, "quietly in your cell. Not in the same cell as Tommy, but I'm sure you'll let Tommy have more appealing accommodations soon. Your sergeant gave us the key when he said we were doing a service for Dr. Watson here, and he knew how much you respected the good doctor and his associate." The tough little Mr. Pritchard put up a bit of defense, but he was ultimately no match for the wodwos, said Jenny. "I am an official wodwo now, and it was my ankle, if I say so, that tripped up the little fellow." "And a nice ankle it is, if I may say so," put in Williams. Everyone was in top form. Everyone was jolly and feeling as if they were kings and queens. The ogre had been dealt with, the honest fellow would be acquitted, and peace and goodwill toward men would return to the valley. And the mine would continue working. The railway, without Pritchard as its new head, everyone took as a given, would leave the tunnel to the Green Man's realm. "And the horse is proved," added Jenny, "to be faster than the silly miniature train. We met him at the tunnel. The boys jumped him as he alighted. End of story." They all cheered. Drinks went round. Jenny declared the next day as a school holiday, and I missed my train. I took the 12:25 the next day, but not before I had, at Jenny and Billy's bidding, taken a trip with them to the tunnel site, to the Green Chapel, as they called it, where Sir Gawain and the Green Knight again, after a year of searching, had endured the final test. We rode horseback. I noticed the sharp teeth on the either side of the valley, the icy stream, and an odd-shaped mound with a hole in the front, with beards of green moss hanging down. "It said a holy hermit lived here ages ago," Billy said. "And perhaps that is why it was chosen, according to some legends, as the keeping place of the Grail," said Janie. "It was already a sacred site." "If this is supposed, secretly, of course, to house the Grail, isn't this rather a bleak place to keep it?" I said. "Would it even be safe from the elements? Where could one hide it?" I looked around at the dark, rough walls. "A carpenter's cup needs a humble home. A famous relic needs an unsuspecting cache," Billy Williams said. "Just walk a bit down there," said Jenny. "There are so many interesting passages. Don't get lost now. Take this lantern, come back in a minute, and tell us what you saw." But I could not tell them. I saw nothing but blank, empty walls. Then a silence fell upon me, not an unpleasant silence. A silence of the earth, a deep, brooding silence of winter beneath the ground, when all the roots are asleep. It was the silence I felt once sitting alone in the little jewel of a chapel near the Seine, not the large and looming Notre Dame, but the diminutive Saint-Chapelle, when the sun hit the blue and red windows. It was the silence of the green world, waiting its return. So when I went back to my new friends, I had nothing to say. Nothing at all.
That was James Tipton reading his story, The Green Man, from the September-October 2022 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. If you've enjoyed listening to this story, check out our website, themysteryplace.com, where you'll find information about our magazine and our sister magazines, as well as links to many more podcasts of authors reading their stories. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. This podcast was produced with the help of our editorial assistant, Kevin Wheeler, and our senior managing editor, Jackie Sherbo. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.